Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 631 for Sunday, November 13th, 2016.
On November 13th, Felix Unger was asked to remove himself from his place of residence. That request came from his wife. Deep down, he knew she was right, but he...
Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We share it all. We answer your questions with the goal being that we all learn at least four new things each and every time we get together here. Sponsors for this episode include VideoBlocks at videoblocks.com/MGG. Yes, that's a new URL, an easier one for you to remember. We'll talk more about VideoBlocks shortly here in the show. Harry's at harrys.com, where MGG coupon code gets you a free post-shave balm with your free trial kit. And Eero at eero.com/MGG. I can't believe it, folks, but Eero has given us permission to tell you about their upcoming Black Friday deals. And so we will do that in a few minutes here. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Greetings, John F. Braun. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Good. Good. All right. So we had last week, we talked a little bit about this, but listener Frank wrote in and he said, I'm a longtime Windows user, but since the rest of my tech is all Apple, I just purchased a new 15-inch MacBook Pro. I was wondering if you could include in the show what your top 10 apps are that everyone needs on their Mac. So instead of it just being my list and John's list, we solicited lists from you. So we're going to read through a lot of these, not necessarily all of them, but I think we have a place where we can really get this done. All right. So we're going to start with Bruce. And that's just because that's where we're going to start. So we're going to list everybody's, but we're not going to double up on anything. Hopefully if I'm smart enough to figure out how to do that. So Bruce says, as a Mac consultant, these are my must-have non-Apple apps that I use daily. Skype, Join.me, Easy Find, Firefox, Google Chrome, Slack, and Text Wrangler. That's what Bruce says. Andy says, iTerm 2, because working on switches, Linux routers, Linux servers and routers, he's using SSH, TMUX and SCP all of the time. VMware Fusion Pro, Airmail, Tweetbot, Spotify, Bartender, iStat Menus, Poofy adds to those, Evernote, Todoist, 1Password, Transmit for FTP, and iMazing. And then he goes on to add Little Snitch, Handbrake, VLC, and Transmission to that list. We're going to talk about some of these, but I just want to get the list out here. Daryl adds 1Password. I don't think that's been said, but maybe it has. Dropbox, Backblaze, Clam XAV. We're going to talk a little bit about antivirus software in the episode later here. Onyx. Mike adds, I don't think it's been said, Keyboard Maestro, BB Edit, which of course is Text Wrangler's older cousin. And then, where are we here? Todd adds to these Divi to resize windows all the time. That's not one that I was aware of, but looks very good. He says he uses that because he has his MacBook Pro that he plugs into different size monitors at home and at work and likes to rearrange things. Alfred, Evernote. After Todd, we have Don. And Don adds Atext, one that I don't think we've mentioned on the show before. Clarify, Microsoft's OneNote. I think we already said Slack. Pixelmator and Walter, which is a very cool video transfer tool that lets you get videos from your Mac to your iOS device without needing to convert. Lewis adds LaunchBar to that. An oldie but a goodie. Hazel, which I don't think we've mentioned yet. Better Touch Tool, and Plex Server. And Gary adds Jump Cut, Carbon Copy Cloner, Time Machine Editor to it. John, you want to go first, or should I think, do I have anything to add? I don't think I do. Oh, yeah, I have one to add to that list.
Okay.
I have default folder to add to that list. So you get to back cleanup.
All right, well, I will. That was on my list as well.
Okay.
For default folder 10.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the latest version of all of these is to be assumed. Yep.
So the ones that I have here that were not mentioned, as far as I know, LastPass, which is competitor to I'm just a LastPass guy. I think you're a one password guy.
But, I am.
Any sort of password manager is essential to me. Fruit Juice to me is an all-in-one tool to
just
take care of your battery. So for any machine that runs on battery, Fruit Juice I love. To make sure cruft doesn't build up, I like App Cleaner.
Okay.
It helps you throw away apps and gets rid of all the ancillary files. Is that the right way to
Say
that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Hardware Growler is a wonderful diagnostic tool that will show you when all sorts of things your Mac connects to and disconnects from all sorts of things, including peripherals and disks and things like that. An oldie but a goodie, but one that I like, Graphic Converter. It does more than convert graphics, but if you want a program that knows how to read a typographic, this to me is the best program to do that sort of thing. And for diagnosing Wi-Fi problems, I like iStumbler.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, man.
One of our favorites.
All right, so
and then two other and just a general category, and I'll mention the ones that I use. But cloud services, the ones that I like are Google Drive, or the ones that I use are Google Drive, OneDrive, and Dropbox.
Oh, we already mentioned Dropbox.
Ah, all right. Yeah. But one or more cloud services is something everybody should have, and then a photo service. My favorite right now is Flickr.
But there's no app for Flickr unless you are a paid Flickr member now on your Mac, right? The Flickr uploader only works if you are a Flickr Pro or whatever, the non-free version. That changed about 6 months ago.
Well, you can run an app on iOS.
Yes, that's correct. The iOS app will still run for free users, but the Mac uploader will not.
Yeah, I don't use the. I'll typically just do a one-off upload. Typically from. Photos.
I'm just trying to keep the blinders on us here, so that we're on Mac apps for people to install. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So going back through this, interesting how many people are using not just alternative browsers but multiple browsers. We had a lot of you suggesting both Firefox and Chrome, which I thought was interesting, and many of you were web designers. Who need to test things in multiple browser environments. One of you, though, was not a web designer, at least one, and when I queried about it, said, I just have some websites that don't work in Safari but do work in either Chrome or Firefox, and so that's the reason for using those, which I found interesting. I tried using iTerm 2 for a little while as a replacement for Terminal. And then when we listed through and posted it in our Facebook group at MacGeekab.com/Facebook, there's a bunch of Terminal, like keyboard shortcuts and tips and tricks that you can do that are very Mac OS integrated. And so I quickly went back to Terminal and it's been great. So I thought that was interesting. Bartender is one that would certainly be on my list if you are a laptop user, or even a user. I mean, at my desk, I've got, 27-inch monitor. So having all these menu bar widgets floating up there doesn't really bother me because I have the room for it. But on a laptop, you may not have room for all of them to display. And so they simply won't display. The menus take over and you might not even notice it, but Bartender cleans that up and gives you a sort of drop down menu, and you can configure how you want it to appear. So if you've got a menu bar widget that like Dropbox's widget, for example, that spins when it's syncing or gives you an error, you can actually have it float up to the main menu bar so that you'll see it there when it's changing, and then it drops back down when it goes idle. So the bartender's a really, really good one in my opinion. Transmit for FTP is stellar. Evernote, we had many of you mentioned both Evernote and Microsoft's OneNote, almost an equal split between those. And of course, we weren't asking about Apple apps, but interesting to see how many of you are using a third-party notes app. John and I are Evernote users here. In fact, it's Evernote from which I'm reading all this stuff. So very interesting that those came up. As you said, password managers, John, a good thing. Cloud services, the one I didn't mention was CloudStation. I used to use BitTorrent Sync, which then became Resilio Sync, and it still works fine. There was about a 2-month period where it was doing a weird thing and wouldn't sync some of my files because they had, I don't know, a quote or an equal sign or something in them, or an asterisk in them is what it was. And, you know, I'm syncing 20 gigs worth of files. I wasn't going to go in and change the names of the ones that had asterisks. So I just switched over to CloudStation again, which is Synology's own cloud syncing service. And man, it's been working great. I am really impressed with it. The user interface is good. It lets me have multiple versions and I can manage them very, very easily. It's actually a much simpler thing to manage than Resilio Sync, and it still lets me do, you know, private cloud. So I really like that one. Kind of going through the list, Keyboard Maestro, we couldn't record Mac Geek Gab without it. Certainly our chapters and all of that stuff are happening that way. And yes, Katie Floyd, I got your email. I have not replied. She's curious how I do the chapters here in the show with Keyboard Maestro. I'm going to put together an article that has all of that stuff and hopefully do that this week. So Keyboard Maestro is awesome. It also manages multiple clipboards, which is, if you aren't using a clipboard manager, Frank or anyone, obviously this kind of spills beyond just Frank's desires, but if you're not using a clipboard manager, your life is about to be more complete, because having a history of the things that were on your clipboard and being able to put multiple things on your clipboard and then paste those out as you wish is awesome. Imagine being on a web page and copying not just the title, not just the URL, but, you know, some snippet of text from it, and then jumping over to an email and pasting all of these, those things in without having to go back and forth between the two apps. I can't make an argument enough for this. When I don't have a clipboard manager on my Mac, I feel like I'm running with mittens on. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else that came up that we have not talked about. So, and I don't think there is. So, yeah, and there's lots of clipboard managers in the chat room. John is suggesting CopyPaste Pro. There's many of them. In fact, Keyboard Maestro as a clipboard manager is probably overkill only because it does so many, many other things. But you may want to do those other things, and so then it's nice to have them all consolidated into one really easy to use app. But yeah, there's tons of them. Just get something where the keyboard shortcuts that do it work for you. Like for me, obviously, Command C is copy, Command V is paste, Command Shift V is what I've set. I think I can't even remember. My hands just know it, but I've got to, you know, I just modify that a little bit and it pops up the menu, and then I can use my arrow keys to pick which item from my clipboard history I want to paste in, and it goes. Very, very cool stuff, Frank. Thank you for asking that question, man. This is cool. Do you have anything to add, John, before we move on to some quick tips here?
No.
Are you sure?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Everything I had on my list, I got out of my system.
Okay. All right. I don't know why your connection keeps going like into Skype land today, but hopefully we can dig you out.
Ooh.
Of there.
Yeah, I'm down to 12K.
Yeah, I know.
And now it's bouncing up to, maybe I got to talk more. I don't know.
Yeah.
Grease the
skids.
The tubes here or something.
Now you sound smooth and buttery.
Yeah, now it's up to 24.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I see it on the technical call info screen that my bitrate is degrading.
It's degrading. Yeah. Yes. Very interesting. All right. Moving to Paul, we've got three or four quick tips. Paul's going to start us off here, I believe. And Paul, he sent us, and we actually posted his screenshot because it was really cool. He went to update to 10.1.1 on his iPhone, but it's a 16 gig iPhone. And so, you know, those are small. And anybody that's ever tried to upgrade a 16 gig iPhone or really any iPhone that's full, will sometimes say, hey, you can't do the over the air update, software update, because there's not enough room on your iPhone. Well, this time Paul sent in a screenshot that says it's got a little dialogue as he goes to update. It says temporarily remove apps to install software update. And it says Excel will be temporarily removed to make storage available for this software update. It will be reinstalled when the update is complete, which I thought was pretty darn cool. So we put a little note up, a cool stuff found note up at TMO, but what a great little tip to know that you can, even if you had gotten out of the habit of doing over the air software updates, you can do it now, which is good. So
yeah,
thank you for sending that in, Paul.
I did something. So I was going through my iPhone and I was just looking at all my different apps, and I still have, harking to the bad old days when you couldn't delete apps. I have a folder called Apple Apps.
Sure.
And I still have a folder called Apple Apps, but I was going through the other day and I was looking and I'm like, you know what? Let me see if I can delete this one now. And that's something they promised in 10.
Yeah.
And the one that I got rid of because I don't have an Apple Watch was Watch.
So here's the thing, though.
And it said, and it gave some sort of message saying, okay, I'll let you delete this, but you won't be able to sync to an Apple Watch. And I'm like, well,
right.
Yeah, I understand that.
Right.
But
right.
It allows you now. But you have the ability to delete more apps than you have in the past.
The thing is, with most of those, and I'm not sure about the Watch app, but I know that with most of those Apple apps, deleting them simply removes them from your home screen, but doesn't actually free up the space that they would have taken up. And I'm not certain that that's true for all of them, but I know that for some, like Mail, I think you can remove, but I don't think it actually gets rid of Mail, because so many things use all those frameworks that Mail relies on that it just hides it from the home screen. That's all.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that was my intent.
Sure.
Well, ideally I'd like to free up the space, but the thing is I don't want it taking up valuable screen real estate.
Right.
So I got rid of it.
Yep. All right. Josh has a great little tip for us. He says, you know how you can two-finger scroll on an Apple trackpad? Try doing it with your first two fingers. Now your second and third fingers, now your third and fourth, now your first and fourth. It doesn't matter which fingers you use, it always scrolls. Except, try it with your thumb and any finger. If you just tried it, you know, nothing happens. Your trackpad, according to Josh here, he says, can seem to tell if your thumb is touching. I assume it detects the angle of each finger, and if they match, it scrolls. If not, it prepares for a pinch, zoom, rotate. Try that on any other brand trackpad, and I bet Apple's the only one that does it. And he's right. I tried this. Now, he's also right about it detecting the angle of your finger, because if I, like, contorted my hand and flattened out my thumb as opposed to using kind of the side of it, which would be the more natural way to do it, it worked. So it really is looking, you know, for the angle or the amount of surface that it takes up. I don't know, but they are somehow detecting it, which is very interesting. So thanks for sharing that, Josh. Fun stuff. Michael, does this work? You have a laptop right in front of you, but it's an older laptop, like a 2012. Is that the case on that too, John? Did you just try it?
What happens is it just moves. So if I use my thumb and a finger, it just moves the cursor.
It's not doing scroll. Okay, so it's been doing this for a while. Very interesting. Michael says, I had many, many songs on iTunes that I wasn't interested in hearing anymore. So rather than deleting all of those, I created a new library by just adding the songs I wanted. When I indexed the songs to my Sonos, I noticed that the playlists were all missing. Then I saw that the iTunes library.xml file was no longer in the iTunes folder. I'd never given this file any thought. I always thought it was just created automatically. So I spent some time trying to figure out how to build it when I noticed in iTunes preferences in the advanced section, there is an option to share iTunes library XML with other applications, and it was unchecked in my new library by default. I checked it, and of course the XML file appeared, and then everything could read it. And this is true. Yeah, that iTunes XML file, it used to be created by default. And then at some point, And I'm going to say it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, they changed that default and it doesn't create it, but you can turn it back on in case you have some third party app. And there's lots of third party apps that rely on it. His Sonos was just an example, but yeah, very, very interesting. So thanks for the reminder on that, Michael. That's one of those things that could send any one of us into a wild goose chase or a needle in the haystack hunt. So thanks for going through the haystack and telling us where to find it. And then Mike he sent it in as a question and then he immediately answered it. He said, somehow I maximized my iTunes window and I can't get it back to normal size. There's nothing on the top of the screen except back, pause, and forward. I thought I read somewhere if I right click on the top, it will bring back the screen where I can kill the Mac screen, but I can't do that either. And he says, and the answer is go to System Preferences, go to Dock, and uncheck the double click a Windows title bar 2 box. There will be many options in that box. One of them is to maximize the screen, but you can zoom it or minimize and all that. So that's the trick, is you had double clicked the title bar. And if you're not using that feature, it may be worth turning it off in System Preferences so that you don't wind up using that feature unintentionally. So, John, you had a quick little tip too for all of our friends here using Synology disk stations.
Yes. So I recently went to, they had a Synology conference in Manhattan, and it's a get together where their partners and people that they like us because we like them. And so I was invited to come and check it out and got to meet all sorts of people that work there. It's great stuff, but they also have a raffle, and dude, I won. I hardly ever win anything, but I won a Synology DS216J, which is one of their lower end units.
Yep.
I also learned the secret of how they name their models. I never knew this, and that the 216, the first number is the number of bays, and the next two numbers is the year it was released. So this is a two-bay unit that was released in 2016.
That's right.
And I also have, thank you to my, also met a, or at the show, was Seagate, because you can put Seagate drives in here, and so I have two of their Iron Wolf 8-terabyte drives in here. And the setup was really easy this time around compared to when I set up my other one, Dave.
Yeah, Disk Station Manager 6 increased the ease of setup on Synology stuff immensely. Really makes it easier for... It still has all of the depth of everything that exists in Synology, but makes that kind of first pass setup much easier. But get to the meat of this, John. Frankly, we don't care that you got a free Synology. Let's tell it. I mean, it's great, but you know, there's a tip here. Yeah.
The tip is, and I was wondering, what can I use this for? And you had suggested, Dave, well, you know, one thing you could do, because you got enough space on there, it's an 8-terabyte, and my other unit is less than that. Why don't you back up one Synology to another? And that's something you can do with their software called Hyper Backup, one of the options. In addition to letting you back up things to the cloud and all sorts of different places, you can back up one of your Synologies to another one. I was like, huh, well, that's a good idea. So, you know, set it up, give it the IP address. And I had to install something called Hyper Backup Vault.
Right. Yeah, you install Hyper Backup Vault on the destination and Hyper Backup on the source. That's right.
Right. And then I set it up and it's like, well, what do you want to back up? Which directories? And I'm like, let me back them all up. And I would schedule it. And so the first backup, of course, takes a real long time. I think there's quite a bit of data that I backed up. And then, Dave, we may have mentioned how we just love Time Machine and how super reliable it is, especially over Wi-Fi.
Okay, so here, just so you know, folks, here the tip is imminent. I swear to you, Mr. Braun is gonna get there. So here we go for a quick.
I just want to comment
for freaking ever.
The thing is, I've had a problem where every now it's going. Sometimes it's weeks, sometimes it's months. But I'll get the message from Time Machine saying, "Oh, sorry, your backup is corrupt. You're gonna have to rebuild it, and it locks you out, and it won't back up anymore." And this just happened a couple of days ago after I started using Hyper Backup. I'm like, what can I do? I don't want to rebuild it again. I'm like, why don't I restore the last known good Time Machine backup, which is stored in one of the folders that I backed up with Hyper Backup? I did that. and did the backup again, and everything was fine.
So even though it was a disk image or a sparse bundle or whatever it is that the Time Machine stores, by restoring that sparse bundle to your main Synology via Hyper Backup, you were able to preserve. So by having a backup of your backup, you didn't have to recreate and start your Time Machine backup from scratch. Frankly, if you're doing Time Machine backups over Wi-Fi, I would highly recommend doing something like this. You don't have to use the Synology thing, but I mean, if you have it, then obviously that's an easy way to go. But no matter what you're doing, if you can make clones of your backups, that might just save you. If you're someone that really cares about the history and preserving the history of your Time Machine backup, then you can do it.
Yeah. So, and it was interesting because the way it appears. So if you look at the file on a Mac, it'll just be a sparse bundle. But on the Synology, it actually is a folder. And within that are other folders. So one is the bands that are part of the backup, and then there's all these support files. I wasn't sure if it was going to work because, you know, the Synology doesn't really know that it's a sparse bundle. It just knows it's a bunch of folders and files.
But yeah.
Worked great.
Yeah, cool. All right. So that was not quite a quick tip, but, you know, there we go. Thank you, John. moving on to Jürgen. I think that was a 5-minute quick tip, so... Jürgen writes, he says, I heard you guys mention Clam XAV, and actually he's not, he doesn't have superpowers. We've mentioned it in the past, as an antivirus software of your choice. He says, well, at least I remember John mentioning it several times. Since I don't want to get caught, I've been using it for several months now, feeling safe and comfortable. Just today, I read an article in a German Mac computer magazine. They tested AV antivirus software with 56 current viruses and 194 potentially unwanted applications. Now here comes the bad news. They excluded Clam XAV from the test because it did not recognize over 80% of the viruses and PUAs that were on their list. By the way, the winner of the test was also a piece of free software called Antivirus from AVG. I will download and install this software right after finishing this email to you. So thanks, Jürgen. Very, very good stuff. And yeah, you know, AVG is very well known on the PC side for providing their free antivirus software. So if you are someone who chooses to use antivirus software on your Mac, I am not yet one of those people. But if you are someone who chooses to, it seems like AVG, at least according to this one German magazine, is the way to go, and Clam XAV might be something that's better put on the shelf for a while, at least until they get back around with it. So thanks, Jürgen. Sorry. Very, very good stuff. Very good stuff. AVG antivirus for Mac. And now it's in the show notes. All right. And then Doug has a little tip for us. Doug writes, where are you, Doug? How come I can't find you? He says, it's sort of a tip and a question. He says, I'm wondering if a 1 or 2 foot piece of fiber optic cable hooked into a cable modem circuit would be enough of an isolator to protect against lightning strikes. I realize this would add cost if it worked, but is there a technical reason this wouldn't work? I'm no engineer, and I imagine there would still be expensive hardware left vulnerable, but wouldn't this be viable as costs come down? And yeah, I mean, if you have fiber optic between any two devices, then there will be no lightning power, you know, and no surge from a lightning strike will cross that fiber optic. That's sort of the way it works. It's non-conductive in that way. And it was the advice I got years ago when we were talking about all the lightning problems I was having because I have that direct buried cable, and people were saying, well, you should do fiber. The problem with fiber is it's expensive because you have to have a, what I'll call a fiber converter. I'm sure there's a much more technical name for it, on both ends to go from either coax to fiber or Ethernet to fiber. And then of course, fiber back to whatever it is you want to go back to. And I don't know if you could do coax to fiber, but certainly you could do fiber on the other side of your Ethernet. You know, the other side of your cable modem where you have Ethernet coming out to your network, that's definitely doable. But But it's a lot cheaper to get one of those things we mentioned, like the PNET 1GB, I think is what it is, from APC, the people that make UPSs. So any thoughts on this, John?
I'm just thinking the only thing that I suppose could damage fiber is the heat from the lightning may render your fiber unusable.
Huh.
As you point out, fiber, right? I mean, it's glass, right?
Well, if lightning were to hit the actual
fiber.
Sure. Yeah. But that's all
I'm
you
just
would
speculating.
Lose. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't conduct electricity.
Conduct it back to your devices. That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Be nice to get fiber here. Well, fiber that I can buy.
Right.
I think I told you, I noticed there's a pole near me that has a fiber junction box, but it's a company that I think does commercial fiber and not for the little people.
So, they might be able to do it for you someday, John.
I mean, I got my Super Zoom camera and I actually got the phone number of the, you know, so they list the name of the
sure.
company and the phone number, but every time I try to call, nobody answers the phone.
Oh, so. That's too bad.
I don't think they're really equipped to deal again to deal with consumers. They're more
right
business
right
fiber.
Right.
They want
well,
to try it,
there's a business opportunity for you. Become a distributor for them. Yeah, just to consumers. I mean, there's the right. It's already right there. All you'd need to do is I would call it the last mile, but it's not even the last mile. It's you know the last 100 feet, and who knows? Maybe there's a business for you. I don't know. Kind of the way I think of things. Terry has a question, John. Terry asks, and he sent some screenshots to go with along with it, but he says, I've just lived with this for a while now, but it's a little crazy making. I have a mix of email accounts, one exchange for my campus email, I'm a professor, and a couple of Gmail accounts. In iOS mail, swiping is crazy. Sometimes it's swipe left to delete and swipe right to archive. Other times it's just the opposite. As you might imagine, this email roulette can be frustrating and slows down processing in an infuriating way. How might I unify this? And he does. He sent some screenshots. And if you use an iPhone and you've ever done a swipe on like from the list of messages in any mailbox, but typically you do this from your inbox, you can swipe one direction and get like more and mark unread and either trash or archive, and then you can swipe the other direction and get either trash or archive. And it can be different depending on your mail account because this decision is made per account and is set by going into settings on your iPhone, settings, mail, accounts. Then you choose the account, and then inside the account, you choose account again, which typically like has your email address, and then go into advanced and then go into move discarded messages into. You have an option here as to what you're going to do. Make this the same thing for all your accounts, because this is what happens. It's really describing what that button at the bottom of a message will do, either trash or archive. And whatever that button does is what I believe the swipe left does. And then the opposite is swipe right. So you probably have some accounts that are set to trash and then some are set to archive. And that's why you're getting different behavior on each of those. So, yeah, go into your accounts and sort of homogenize this particular setting, because you have an option, at least in my accounts, I have an option where it says move discarded messages into deleted mailbox or archive mailbox. Make that the same for all of them. And then you should be in good shape. Interesting question. Thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, that's a advanced is a good place to be. The looking at all
it's
the
tough
settings
to
here,
get there. It was like when I went to write this for him, I'm like, dude, you gotta like, yeah, there's like 16 taps to get there. Yeah.
The one thing that I do notice, just a tip for people, especially if you're running mail on both iOS and your Mac, is there's a remove parameter there. And I think we've had people bring this up in the past. Make sure that it's set the same on all of your computers or devices.
Yeah.
So, for example, here, I'm noticing that for this one account, it's remove after 1 week, which I think is reasonable for deleted messages. But we've had people bring this up to us saying, hey, you know, my messages are disappearing and I didn't delete them. It's like, well, have you checked all your machines? And typically one machine, it'll honor, you know, the one that has the shortest time frame.
So here's my advice before you decide what to check any of those. I totally agree that they all should be set the same, or all of them should be set to never. And one of them should be set to, you know, like maybe your Mac, your main Mac, should be set to, you know, delete after 30 days or a week or whatever you want. But having all of them sort of managing that can get to be a little screwy. But before you even decide that, look at what your mail provider does. Because, for example, if you use Gmail, that is going to expunge messages from your trash can after 30 days, regardless of what your clients tell it to do. So you might as well just set them all to never and let Gmail manage it. And that way it's only ever being managed from one place. So unless you want it expunged more frequently and then follow the other advice. But yeah, I agree that they should all be homogenized, or one, they should all be never, and one should be doing all the heavy lifting of that. That's how I like to do it anyway. Anything else on that, John?
No, I'm with you, man. Continue, shall we?
You know what I want to do, John, is I want to talk about our three sponsors. Can I do that?
Absolutely.
All right. Our first sponsor today is Eero. And even if you've already heard me talk about Eero, please listen today, because I have a deal coming up for you that they have shared with me. Eero is enterprise-grade Wi-Fi in an easy-to-use package for your house. Let's think about it, right? 5 years ago, even, you didn't have a ton of Wi-Fi devices in your house. You had a couple. And it wasn't really a make or break if they were out of range. Compare that to an office, though. Even a small office, you might have had, you know, 20 or 30 Wi-Fi devices. Nowadays, you might have that at your home, and your home deserves the same type of connection and connectivity that an office would have, but in an easy-to-use package. And that's what Eero does. This is a distributed wireless mesh. Translation, bathes your home in Wi-Fi. You put one Eero unit by your cable modem, and then you put others elsewhere in your house, and it figures out the mesh for you. This is not range extenders, folks. This is true wireless mesh. Here's the deal I have for you. Come Black Friday, there is an awesome price break that is available for you for Eero. And they don't just limit you to buying a 3-pack anymore. Some homes will need a 3-pack. Some homes will do just fine with 2. So here's the deal. Normally, a 3-pack is $4.99. On Black Friday and for that whole weekend, $3.99. Normally, a 2-pack is $3.49 for that Black Friday weekend, $2.99. So you're saving $100 on a 3-pack and $50 on a 2-pack. And if you just want one, maybe to add to a system, or if you feel like your house is small enough that just one, you can now get an Eero, normally $1.99. You can get it for $149, saving $50 there. So this is from November 24th to 28th. Go to Eero.com. It's available other places, but if you go to Eero.com and buy it and use the coupon code MGG, you get free overnight shipping. So go check this out. Eero.com, coupon code MGG for your free overnight shipping. And I know it's crazy for me to say this, but wait until the weekend of Black Friday, November 24th. To November 28th, go to Eero.com, buy it then, use your coupon code. You're going to save somewhere between $50 and $100 on this awesome wireless mesh system. You're going to love it. Our thanks to Eero for sponsoring this episode. Our next sponsor is VideoBlocks at videoblocks.com/MGG. Yes, that's right. We've got a new URL for you now. Last week, I told you about VideoBlocks. This week, I actually got a chance to use it. VideoBlocks is this awesome site that has stock video footage. And I know that doesn't sound exciting to everyone, but man, the way this site works is awesome. You just go and you get this page and you start searching, right? You can just use some of their categories, or you can search for stuff, and it just surfaces all these video clips that match what you're looking for. And you can preview them all right in this one web page. It really takes a lot to impress me on the web these days in terms of functionality. video blocks totally blew me away. And then, of course, you can, if you see one you like, you can dig in. And then if you want it, you sign up for a video block subscription, right? And if you go to videoblocks.com/MGG, you get a subscription for $149 for an entire year. That's $100 off their normal price. If you're doing any kind of video editing or video production, that $149 for a royalty-free video is amazing. So you got to check this out. Go to videoblocks.com/MGG, sign up, and you get a year. Here's the other thing. You get access for that same year to their sister site, Audioblocks, that does the same thing, but for audio. Next week, we'll tell you a little bit more about the details of that. Simple, unrestricted licensing on both Videoblocks and Audioblocks. It's 100% royalty free, even after your subscription has come to an end. So anything you get during that subscription, you have access to and you can use ongoing. Check it out. Videoblocks.com/MGG. You get a year at that URL for just $149. Our thanks to Videoblocks for sponsoring this episode. Our third sponsor for today is Harry's at harrys.com. Harry's makes some of the best razors I've ever used at a shockingly low price. It's amazing how fantastic these razors are all by themselves. And then when you look at the price, you'll shake your head and wonder, why have I been overpaying for razors all my life? Those other companies must have huge margins. I don't understand it, because what Harry's can deliver me for, I mean, just a few bucks is amazing. These razors, I've never experienced a shave as close as I get with Harry's. And I've been doing this for, you know, whatever, let's say many, many decades. It's really quite something. And the blades, when you buy replacements, are just about $2 a blade. These things last forever, too. I don't know if Harry's wants me to even say that, but they totally do. Like, I use them probably twice as long as I would use any other blade, and they just hold up. So here's the thing, though. Even if you have been a Harry's customer in the past, as long as you haven't taken advantage of their free trial, you get to take advantage of it now, even if you're already a Harry's customer. So what you do is you go to harrys.com and you click the start trial button right there. What that's going to get you is a handle with a blade, foaming shave gel, and a razor cover. They're also going to ask you to sign up for a plan to get more blades down the road. But here's the thing. First of all, the free trial set is free. You're just going to pay $3 shipping. And you don't have to continue through with your shave plan if you don't want. I can't imagine you're not going to want to, and neither can they. That's why they're willing to do this. You got to check this out. Go to harrys.com, sign up for your trial, and when you're checking out, use coupon code MGG. That gets you a free tube of post-shave balm included in your order. So check it out. harrys.com. Sign up for your free trial. You're going to pay $3 in shipping. Use the coupon code MGG and you'll get a tube of post-shave balm included in your order because you're a friend of ours. Our thanks to Harry's for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. We do need to talk about Thunderbolt and USB-C again.
Why?
Because it's the world we live in. Thunderbolt in general.
We'll USB-C. Live
in. Yeah, well.
We get the latest Mac.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Listener David writes, he says, I've ordered the new MacBook Pro. I have several Thunderbolt 1 and Thunderbolt 2 accessories. I was looking for a USB-C hub with USB 3 and a Thunderbolt port and have not found one. I've seen a few with DisplayPort, but I'm not sure if that DisplayPort, mini DisplayPort is what that would be, means that it can also be used as a Thunderbolt 1 and 2 port. Can you recommend the best approach for connecting Thunderbolt devices to the new MacBook Pro? Yeah, this is, pardon me, this is definitely going to be a point of confusion because, as we said recently, Thunderbolt doesn't really have a port. Thunderbolt 1 and 2 have been carried traditionally across mini DisplayPort, but not every mini DisplayPort, but when there is a Thunderbolt-capable mini DisplayPort, that's how you get Thunderbolt 1 and 2 across it. And of course, Thunderbolt 3 is going across a Thunderbolt capable USB-C port. I had to get that right. So the question is, how do you know? You've got to just look at the specs on each adapter. And you know, adapter is even the wrong term, but it's as good as we're going to get. So you can call it dongle if you want, right? But that's what you're going to need to look at, is what devices out there have Thunderbolt 1 and 2 capable mini display ports that will plug into your USB-C on your new MacBook Pro. It gets crazy, because those same devices won't do anything for you on the MacBook that also has a USB-C shaped connector, albeit with different capabilities. So it's fun, isn't it, John?
No,
it's very confusing.
Not if it's confusing.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm almost certain that if and when I do get one of the latest machines that has the USB-C slash Thunderbolt 3,
yeah,
then I'm going to have to get a dock.
Oh, yeah, the dock is the way to go.
And I think our pals at OWC make a fine option.
Yeah.
I checked.
Is there a USB-C dock? I don't know if have they announced one? I forget. Because they've got a USB-C dock, but at least the one that I'm seeing here does not have any Thunderbolt on it, right? It's just got five USB 3.1 Gen 1 ports, gigabit Ethernet, an SD card reader, HDMI,
yeah,
audio.
I'm seeing the same thing you're mentioning.
So yeah,
I guess they're working on it.
But yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? Like, that is certainly one of the best USB-C docks on the market, but because it hasn't been geared for anything that was Thunderbolt capable, it just doesn't have that yet. But in the chat room, Mac Vader is saying he thinks they've announced it, and I think he's right. USB-C Thunderbolt dock.
Chat room? What's the chat
room? At MacGeekab.com/stream, John, of course.
Of course.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I feel like you're right. Off the top of my head, I can't find it. But yeah, this is the thing, is you've just got to be really, really thoughtful, and don't try to look it up and make a purchasing decision while you're recording a podcast for tens of thousands of people. Much better to just go and look. And you've got to ask these vendors, because this is all very, very new. Chances are, today there's very little on the market that's going to be a one-stop shop for what it is that you want to do. But there you go. There is, and thankfully we have many listeners in the chat room, so we do have a link now that we can put in the show notes for the what they're calling the OWC Thunderbolt 3 dock. So this, for $279, will get you the SD card reader, audio in and out, five USB 3.1 Gen 1 ports, SPDIF, FireWire 800, gigabit Ethernet, mini display port, but just for mini display port. It doesn't look like that's going to do Thunderbolt 1 or 2, and then dual Thunderbolt 3 ports that are USB-C ports. So even with this, and we've got to ask, but even with this, you might have to get... There are single, I've seen on Amazon, and they're from, you know, what I would have called, at least the ones I found, no name vendors, but that have USB-C to Thunderbolt 3 capable USB-C to Thunderbolt 2 capable mini display port adapters for exactly that. But maybe this OWC one will do it. It doesn't say that it will. And again, that's why we've got to ask. So. It's pretty crazy. But yeah, search for Thunderbolt 3 to Thunderbolt 2 on Amazon. That would be the thing to look for if this thing won't do it. And it's hard to say. So, but even this, they're saying, isn't going to ship until February 2017. So the question is, you know, what do you do until then? And I'm not sure that there's an answer. So, I don't know. Are you going to get
no
one of these? Oh, okay. I thought, you know, when you said that, it shocked me. I didn't think that this appealed
maybe
to
someday,
you.
But for now, my 2012.
Sure.
15-inch non-retina is serves all my needs nicely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Cool. All righty. Let's talk about this. Denise asks, I think Denise asks, there it is. I'm getting there. I would like to share a couple of non-copyright DVDs that contain old home movies. I've just had them copied from old video cassette tapes onto DVD at the Photoshop in town. I would like to now share them with my iTunes library and then share that part of my library with my mom so she can watch them on her iPad. I've asked this question on Apple Discussions, which I always find very helpful, and they suggested using Handbrake, but I'd like your opinion on this app and also your thoughts on any chance of doing this on my Mac, which is a 5K Retina late 2014 iMac running El Capitan, without having to download any other apps. Well, I don't think you're going to find a way to do this with El Capitan without downloading any other apps. I think you're going to need something non-Apple to convert those DVDs. And Handbrake is a perfect way to rip the DVD into a format that's understandable by iTunes. And then you can share those resulting files with anyone. They will not have any copy protection on them. And to be quite frank, if you take a copyrighted DVD and rip it with Handbrake, the resulting file, you could, from a technological standpoint, share with anyone because it will not have any DRM or copy protection on it. Now, whether you should or legally are allowed to be sharing those is a whole other thing, and you need to check on that or not. That's up to you. But if your DVDs start their lives as, you know, yours and you could share with anyone, then of course, with home movies and stuff, you're fine. So yeah, Handbrake would be probably the best thing. It's certainly very, very simple for the most part. It has a user interface that has lots of options, but you can choose one of the presets and just go. I would choose the Apple TV 3 preset or Apple TV 4 now, sorry, preset in Handbrake, because that's going to get you a decent sized video that also will be compatible with iTunes and anything else Apple that you try and throw at it. iTunes, but here's the thing. iTunes doesn't really make it easy to share these files unless you're plugging your mom's iPad into your computer. But you could use Dropbox or something like WeTransfer or even a thumb drive to send them to your mom's computer if she has a computer, and then she could sync them from her, if she has a computer, she can sync them from the computer to her iPad, or you could plug her iPad into your computer. Or we could use the thing that we mentioned earlier in the show, and that's an app called Walter, W-A-L-T-R, from a company called Softarino. And this makes it pretty easy to take any videos that you have and put them into your iOS videos app. It's pretty amazing the way it all works. And it's able to take anything. Although if you're creating them with Handbrake in a way that puts them in a format that iTunes can understand, then iTunes typically will transfer them to your iPad. But Walter's pretty cool the way that it does this. And they've just come out with a new version, but it's a drag and drop thing. It's a really, really simple app, and it just puts the stuff out there and puts it in a format that your iPad's going to understand. It's pretty awesome. So highly recommend it, and it's worth checking out. Yeah,
You could email it.
You could. That's right.
Because it would using use mail drop.
Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, I like that.
I was thinking in the back of my mind here, and I just looked. So yeah, so MailDrop is Apple's technology that will, it won't send it as an attachment. It actually uses, I guess, iCloud in the background or puts it on a server somewhere, and then the recipient can download it. From what I see here, the limitation is that it'll only handle files up to 5 gigs, but I think most DVDs the size of that file is going to be less than 5 gigs. I'm almost certain.
Right. Yeah, it would be. Yeah. Especially once it's converted and compressed with Handbrake. Here's the problem with using MailDrop to someone who you know is going to read it on an iPad. I am almost certain that they will be able to get the MailDrop file and view it, but they will have to view it inside their Mail app. I don't believe iOS is going to provide any path to take it from the attachment from Mail and put it into the Videos app. And that's the really frustrating part. I mean, the same is true if you get an MP3, you know, and you want to add it to your music app on your Mac. It's easy. You just drag the MP3 from Mail into iTunes and you're done. You cannot do that on an iOS device. And that's very frustrating. So there you go. But yeah, MailDrop can do it. So in the chat room, we are hearing that actually a great suggestion is an app called Infuse from a company called Firecore. And it will do very, very similar things. You can transfer into Infuse. This doesn't put them in the Videos app on iOS. It puts them into the Infuse app. But very, very good stuff and works really, really well and will play formats that that otherwise are unplayable on the iPad. So sorry, getting all kinds of feedback from all of you, and it's fantastic, but it's throwing me off a little bit. So it's good stuff though. Very, very good stuff. Any other thoughts on this, John?
No, that's about it. I Handbrake to MP4s is what I do.
And yeah.
Stream it with Video Station.
Right. And if you've got a Synology, that would be the other way to do it, is you could set up either a Synology server or even a Plex server if you don't have a Synology, but you could set up a Plex server on your Mac and point Plex at your iTunes Videos library. And then I think your mom would need a Plex Pass account, but to download them into Plex on her computer, or you would need one that you could add her to. And that would be another way to do it. And then she can stream these from you and download them to her iPad and just watch inside the Plex app, which would be another good way to do it, especially if you're going to have lots of these things and you just want to be able to make them available for her without, you know, having to go and mess with it all the time. Mm-hmm. Set her up with Plex once, or Video Station, or DS Video if you've got a Synology, and then populate the library for her and you're done. It's actually not a bad idea.
Because I know some files that you and I have exchanged as of late, Signature Profiler involved, come from your Synology, as far as I can tell. You send me a link to the file that's stored in your Synology.
It's awesome. Yeah, it's because what's cool about that is I'm doing that with, I mentioned that I use CloudStation now, right? Which is like private Dropbox, if you will. And it's built in and freely available to anyone using a Synology device. And so you set up the CloudStation server on the Synology, and then there's a CloudStation app on the Mac. That's what I was talking about before. And what's cool about it is anything that I have synced with CloudStation, I can go into a folder on my Mac. I can see the file. And like you said, I was sending you a test version of a thing for SigPro, which is a new app it's a rebuild of an app that lets you manage your signatures on the Mac. And I was sending John this link to the beta that they had sent me, and they told me it was cool to share with you. And I just right click on the file in the Finder and say, get shareable link. And not only does it provide me with a shareable link, but I can, if I wanted, I could make it so that you had to type a password to get the file. I can also set how long that shareable link is good for. So I set it for a week. And then that way, after a week, I don't have to worry that someone else, if they stumble onto this email a year from now or whatever, is going to be able to download it from me. I can set a maximum number of times to download, and then just puts the link on my clipboard and I send it to you. And it seems like, from what you're telling me, it works, which is good. But yeah, CloudStation's really cool. It's the Mac app for it has come a long, long way. There was a reason that I stopped using it. And like I said, I came back to it, what, 3 or 4 months ago, and I've been totally blown away. So it's good stuff. It's fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can we add SigPro to our must-have Well,
yes.
Depending on how your email is set up,
right?
If you have multiple email addresses associated with an account, you almost need Signature Profiler. You'll go insane.
Yeah, but here's the thing: we have to stop calling it Signature Profiler because that's what it was called before Sierra. It's right. Just SigPro. Yeah, but other than that, yes, please let's add it to the list. It's and you know I'm surprised. Anytime we make these kinds of lists, there's always things that I forget about, and this is definitely one of them. SigPro, I didn't include and couldn't live without it, and also Mail Acton from the same company now. Scott Little and Scott Morrison merged their mail plugins together into a company called Small Cubed, and SigPro is from them, as is Mail Acton. And I couldn't live without it. Mail Acton lets me apply rules with keystrokes. So if you think about archiving your mail or doing things like a lot of times you folks sometimes will send me an email to my personal email address, which is for my direct email address, which is fine. But I want to answer it when I'm in Mac Geek Gab mode so that I can put it into the flow of the show. So I hit Control G. And what that does is it moves the message to my Mac Geek Gab folder, and B, it marks it as unread. Otherwise I'll think I've dealt with it already and leaves it over there. And I do that with a mail rule, but the triggering it with Command G. So this is mail rules for things that have already come in. Super, super handy. That another tool I just can't live without. So it is good stuff. Any other thoughts, John? Am I missing anything?
We're always going to be missing something.
But. I know. Well, as we're pointing out to ourselves, that's good. That's good. It's good. All righty. Where else are we here? While we're back now, circling back to the subject of movies and ripping them, listener Craig has a question that always drives me crazy. He says, I have seen many movies with short passages of, he says, you talked about forced subtitles, something I did not know about until you recently discussed it when you were talking about ripping DVDs. And that was in, I think, two or three episodes ago. He says, I've seen many movies with short passages of foreign language, which put subtitles on the screen. But I'd noticed that when I ripped my DVDs, these did not appear when watching that ripped copy of the movie. The movie Chef comes to mind for this. Is there a guide about subtitles and how to handle them? I find lots of individual bits of information, but none as comprehensive in range as your brief discussion. I would love to find out more, especially how best to actually include these four subtitles and or burn them into the movie when ripping by disc. So, yeah, it really depends on what you start with for your source. When I'm ripping movies these days, and it's typically Blu-rays, I don't rip straight with Handbrake. I rip with something called Make MKV, and that makes an MKV file and folder full of all the stuff that was on the DVD, including all the subtitles and all of that, that little magic. And then I do use Handbrake, but I don't use it directly. As easy as the user interface is, there are lots of options. Don Melton, he's retired now. He worked for Apple and was the lead of the team that created WebKit and Safari. Don is obsessed about having his movie library ripped in such a way that it looks as good as anything he might download from, from Apple, or perhaps better. And so he really got obsessive, as great programmers often do, about building a script that automatically, it takes a look at the movie, it makes some decisions about it, and then it just rips it. So you really don't have to stop and think at all. But you do have to use the command line in order to be able to use his scripts. And there's instructions, and I'll put them out there. But by using Make MKV, and it pulls all the subs and all of that stuff, you can then go ahead and rip a movie from MKV into MP4 format with Don's scripts. And it does, it uses Handbrake, but it uses the terminal version of it. But it's very simple. You just literally type transcode video space and then the file name of the MKV movie file, and it takes care of the rest, including finding the subs as long as they're in the folder and named correctly, which Make MKV will do. And then I just take that folder and put it in, but you know, but in accessible to whatever it is I'm going to stream, I'm going to use to stream to my Apple TV, and Plex works just fine with it. Plex really, it's a multifaceted approach dealing with subtitles. Handbrake will let you, there is an option on the subtitles tab buried in there that says, burn forced subtitles. My experience doesn't always get it quite right, but for some reason with Don scripts and doing it from MKV, it does. And I don't know why that is, but it seems to work for me. So, but yeah, it's an awful little, process to deal with subtitles, because there's many different formats of them and all of that. Any thoughts? Have you dealt with any of this, John?
No.
Okay. Do you transcode your videos to your, what do you do? Do you put Blu-rays on your disc station?
No, because I don't have a Blu-ray. I only have a Blu-ray player. I don't have a Blu-ray, external Blu-ray drive.
Right.
So the answer is no. Though, you know, I'm thinking.
They're cheap. I mean, like $40 and you can have a USB Blu-ray drive that will let you rip these things.
Yeah, I should pick one up. The other thing is, it could be a little hardware project, is that I do have a Blu-ray player, and I'm sure there's, if I take the thing apart, and I got a long time, it's a Sylvania, which is actually made by somebody else. And I think my benchmark was, as soon as they go below $100, I'll buy one. And as soon as it went below $100, I bought a Blu-ray player.
Sure.
And there's a player, it does, you know, not only Blu-rays, you know, to play back other media, it has an SD card slot. It's really nice.
Yeah.
But I'm almost sure if I pop that thing open, there would be some sort of interface on the circuit board there. So I could hack together an interface or just spend the coin on an external one because they're inexpensive.
Yeah.
But at this point, I rip DVDs on occasion if I get stuff from my library and I don't get around to watching it and have to return it. I'll rip it and then watch it and then I'll delete it. Technically, that may be naughty, but...
That definitely sounds naughty. Yeah.
No, come on. I'm virtually... It's just... I'm just extending the borrowing time.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, there's another solution, actually. I don't know if you ever used this. I haven't either. They got older movies. There's something called Hoopla.
Yeah.
And typically, I guess your library can sign up to them, and they will allow you to virtually rent older titles. I haven't found any. Haven't used it yet. So that's what I do. Yeah, again, it may be minorly naughty. Sorry.
Yeah.
Don't tell.
We won't judge you other than right now. How's that sound?
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Moving along. You want to take us to Dan, John?
I'm going to take us to Dan. Dan had a good one. Had, because problem solved. So Dan writes and says, so I have a weird problem I haven't been able to resolve yet, and I'm hoping someone can offer some suggestions. I have an iMac running macOS Sierra and a MacBook Air running macOS Sierra. The MacBook Air is fine. However, on the iMac and Safari, I can't seem to log out of Gmail without closing the window or closing Safari. I've attached screenshots to show the problem. Normally, you would click on the icon in the upper right when you are logged in and select logout. However, when I click on the logo, it just disappears. If I click in the area again, it shows back up. This occurs regardless if I click on the application grid or the notification icon. Each of these will disappear if I click on them and then reappear if I click again. I've rebooted, cleared the cache, and even removed the com.apple.safari.plist without any luck. This only affects Safari on the iMac. Chrome works fine.
Huh.
So that got me thinking.
Be careful of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Steam will... Whatever. So some diagnosis has already been done here. It happens on Safari on one machine or not the other. So it must be not Safari. So it's not a Safari problem, but it's a way of extending the functionality of a browser problem, was my suspicion. So you may ask yourself, how do I extend the functionality of a browser? And there are two ways to do that. So this is what I offered. I said, you know, maybe it's a Safari extension. So the Safari browser, they have things called extensions that let you do extra good things with your browser. And you can see those by going to Safari, Preferences, Extensions. And there'll be a list of one or more, if you've installed any, extensions. Now, the nice thing is that this is a place where you can actually enable or disable them one by one. So that was my suggestion. Do this and see if one of the extensions is either... Well, the other thing you can do is if you go into that section, you can see if maybe an extension needs an update. Sometimes there are bugs or issues with new web technology, and the extension writer has to update their extension. Mm-hmm. So, and you'll see that. And actually, I think you can set it to automatically update extensions that you use, or you can do it manually. I think I do it manually just because I want control. So that could be one thing. The other way to extend a browser's functionality, but this is like the old and busted technology, and it's kind of on its way out. But it's worth mentioning because you may be using this and not knowing it, is that these are called internet plugins. And in Safari, you go to Safari, Help, and say Installed Plugins. And when you do that, you will see a list of whatever plugins are installed for Safari. And actually, there is a standard for this. So as far as I know, the plugins will work across different browsers. They use this standard. I think it's called NSAPI or something, Netscape API. It's some standard, but it's something that it's not the preferred way to extend functionality
anymore. Sure.
Anymore. So I offered that, and the response was, thanks. I was too close to the problem. It was the Safari extension click to flash.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It's worth taking a look in your Safari extensions folder to see what you've got there. And it's not a folder. I don't know why I said folder. But if you go to, Safari Preferences Extensions, and you can see what you've got. You can see if there's any need to update, and you can turn things off here, which is really handy. For troubleshooting and for no other reason. Also, while you're here, though, I would highly recommend going to the security tab, and where you have internet plugins, where it says allow plugins, you can go to plugin settings. And this is somewhere where Safari really, really shines, because if you go to the Adobe Flash player, yes, I know we're all supposed to hate Flash, but there are some sites where it's something you really want to use. The thing is, click to Flash doesn't hide the fact that you have Flash from sub websites, right? Or from any websites. It in fact still advertises that you have Flash. It just doesn't let the Flash run. The problem with that is if you visit a website that has a very graceful fallback to something better like HTML5, if it sees some websites, not all, but if it sees that you have Flash, it will use that anyway. But if it sees you don't have Flash, it will fall back to HTML5 and you won't have any problem whatsoever. So the ideal scenario would be to hide the fact that Flash, effectively disable Flash for all of the websites that exist out there, and then only enable it for those where you know you really want to use it. And sometimes you'll go to one of those and it'll just say, hey, if you have Flash disabled, it'll say you need to download Flash. Safari actually lets you have the best of both worlds. Here's how you do it. You go into Safari, Preferences, Security, and then click on the little box that says button that says plugin settings, ... Click on Adobe Flash in here. At the bottom of the screen, it says when visiting other websites, and you get to pick whether it asks it's off or it's on. For this, choose off. So now when you visit websites, your browser will not advertise the fact that you have the Flash plugin. Effectively, websites will interpret that as you don't have the Flash plugin. And then what you can do is you can add websites to this list where you turn it on. So for me, for example, I know that when I visit Ticketmaster.com, I want Flash to be used because they've got a seat picker that is only available to people using Flash. It won't even offer it to you if you don't have Flash. So it falls back gracefully, but doesn't give me the functionality that I know exists. So I go here, and it's cool because you can set it for currently open websites. So I visit Ticketmaster in my example, and then I would come in here and change the dropdown only for Ticketmaster from off to on. I could also change it to ask, if I really wanted to, you know, to have it essentially mimic that click to flash behavior where it says this website wants to use Flash. Do you want us to let it? But I already know that I want to let it. So I do that. And you can be very, very granular about it. It's very, very cool. So fun stuff for sure.
It is. And I'm glad you mentioned this because I had forgotten that Safari offers a way to interface with the plugin directory. Otherwise, you'd have to fish around in there. And typically, it's located in either home library, internet plugins, or slash library slash plugins. And that's another way, but this is a much nicer way because it tells you a lot of things. Additional things about the plugin that you can't see from the file itself.
Yep.
Like this. And actually, I'm looking now at my plugins, and some of these are old and busted. And
I there's that too.
Disable or remove them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking here. I got an eMusic plugin. Oh my gosh, I haven't used eMusic in ages. Are they still around? Oh gosh.
Yeah, you can get rid of. Well, that's the other thing is talking
Silver
about
Silverlight here. Oh my gosh.
Silverlight is still used, isn't it? Isn't doesn't
Microsoft
Amazon Prime Video uses Silverlight, I think.
Oh, I don't use that.
Sure, but I'm just saying. I mean, it's you know that's still in use, but there's good reason to update it. So
yeah, the thing that I did, I actually removed Flash from my system. So at one point, I thought our own Jeff Gamet was a crazy person because he said you should really remove that.
And the thing is,
at some point, I think most of us had decided that the security risks in Flash are just too much. And so I actually remove it. And if I need to run something with Flash, I'll use Chrome. Chrome has Flash built in. So that's a strategy you may want to consider.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, and that's another way to do it. I prefer to just stay in Safari, and this lets me, you know, this lets me truly have the best of both worlds. All right. I think we have time for one more, and I would love to go quickly here on Bill. And Bill asks, he said, last night I upgraded to iOS 10.1. Since then, when opening admittedly older apps, I sometimes get a message that it may slow my iPad down if the developer doesn't update the app. And he showed us a screenshot where it says FreeCell HD may slow down your iPad. The developer of this app needs to update it to improve its compatibility. Do you know what in particular it is about these apps that's triggering this message? So far, it only does this the first time the app is opened after the update. I don't get it on subsequent launches. This is Apple's way of shaming developers that have left their apps unupdated for a while and are still using their 32-bit compiled versions. They're really trying to get people to update their apps and compile them for 64-bit. It's really Apple's way of letting you know that the app hasn't been updated in a long time. Does it make it potentially less efficient? Yeah. Is it something that you're going to notice? Probably not, but it could be, maybe. The problem is, and a lot of these apps, it's not just as simple as Apple saying, hey, recompile it for 64-bit. It's recompile it for 64-bit and adhere to all the new guidelines and restrictions that we have in place now for iOS 10. And some apps simply couldn't exist if they had to adhere to those restrictions. So an app developer is left with the choice of leaving the old version out there, essentially being grandfathered into the store with that specific version that, yes, has this 32-bit limitation, or updating the app and losing whatever functionality they would have to lose because of Apple's restrictions. So it's kind of a weird thing with Apple's review department that for many apps puts them in this position. But for some apps, it's because the app has been, you know, it's lost, right? The developer's not updating it anymore. It's end of life. And this is part of that process. They just haven't pulled it from the store yet, or you haven't pulled it from your device yet. So thoughts on this, John? Am I missing anything?
No, you're right. All things. So all current processors or the current processors on both the Mac and iOS are 64-bit processors.
Right.
The thing is, all things being equal, 64-bit code will run better than 32-bit code. So yeah, that's kind of what you said already. Sometimes there's a reason that they're still on 32-bit. It could be their library that they depend on, maybe not available for 64-bit. That has happened in the past.
Sure.
Though typically it also means, it's the developer just hasn't been paying attention to it. And I noticed this too, I think on two apps on my phone. So iOS 10 seems to have reactivated that ability. And I had one or two apps that would come up and say this.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It happened during the betas. I remember seeing people report it, and then it seems like 10.1 sort of resurfaces it. So, yep.
Yeah. Cool. You may want to, if you're curious and you want to make sure that your Mac is running at peak performance, you may want to go into Activity Monitor. CPU is one place, and it'll show you. If you activate it, you may have to right-click and say show kind. But if you show kind, Dave, it'll tell you what kind of app it is. And there are two types, 32-bit and 64-bit.
Wait, what are you talking about with this right-click thing? I'm in Activity Monitor. I'm in CPU. Right-clicking doesn't do...
Well, if you run...
Right-click...
What I'm saying is right-click on the bar on the top.
On the header bar. Got it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Kind may not be available. And actually, if you right click on that bar, that will show you all of the categories of information that can be showed in Activity Monitor.
Sure.
It looks like there's about 20 of them. You probably don't
I didn't realize you could right click there and do it. I always do it in the view menu. I go to columns and then you can it's the same list. You can select from there.
Okay. But the kind column will show if an app is 32-bit or 64-bit.
Yes, it will.
You really should be running all 64-bit apps on a modern computer and modern operating system. But for example, I'm looking and I do have a few things here. So I have something called Echo Backup, which is an old piece of software that came with a Lexar drive that does backups. That's 32-bit. DD Assist, which is Drobo's software, is also 32-bit. So I guess they haven't gotten around to it.
And despite all my ravings about how great Synology's CloudStation app is, it shows up as a 32-bit app here. It hasn't caused me any issues, but
But it's not running it at peak performance,
right?
So you probably hadn't noticed it, but
right.
Something you may want to do and just go through your apps and just if you see a 32-bit one, see if there is one that is 64-bit. Now again, like in the case of Drobo, it could be that I don't know. I suspect in their case they just haven't gotten around to updating DD Assist ever.
Well, they do update it regularly. Yeah, there might be, like, I'm noticing what's interesting is one of the apps that shows up is Nicecast, which is the one that we stream to our Icecast relay. It's essentially the app that lets us stream the show live to you folks while we're recording. And that's a 32-bit app. It's from Rogue Amoeba. But I'm also running Audio Hijack 3. And that is most certainly 64-bit. And that's also from Rogue Amoeba. And those guys keep on top of this stuff. Nicecast is updated regularly. So I'm curious, there's a reason that they haven't updated Nicecast to 64-bit. And maybe they've looked at it and said, no, this app, it's better if we leave it this way. In fact, I'm sure they've decided it's better if we leave it this way. I'm sure this is an intentional decision, not an oversight on their part. So.
Of course, another one that I see here, which we'll have do a finger wag to Apple. It's called DBFS Events D. I'm almost certain that's a part of the operating system.
Well, it's being run by Root.
And I think Apple is responsible for that. So come on, Apple, get with it, man.
That's right. Thanks, Apple. All right.
Update your own software.
That's right.
Take your own advice.
So next week, I believe next week, it's certainly at some point within the next 2 weeks, it'll either be next week or the week after, we are doing a deep dive on routers and we'll really be kind of exploring all the mesh routers that are out there. I've had the chance to mess with a bunch of them. And so that'll be something we're going to do either for 632 or 633. So if you have any questions or certainly any thoughts to share, anything, just send them to us, feedback@macgeekgab.com, and we will include those in our thought process as we put together this next deep dive.
I don't know. I really prefer to send any sort of question to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Right, I know, but honestly, John, let's be real about this. Feedback@macgeekgab.com is better, unless... You support us directly in our premium subscriber, and then premium at MacGeekGab.com is absolutely the right way to get in touch with us, because we will give your email a little bit of special attention before we get to all the rest. Although we do try to get to all of them, as we show every week. Not necessarily in the show, but we answer all of them. That's the goal, even if we don't include them in the show. You can call us, 224-888-GEEK, and leave us a voicemail or a text there. John, Geek is
4335.
And our Facebook group continues to astound me. Again, I mentioned it earlier in the show, MacGeekUp.com/Facebook. Come join us there. Great conversation, great people, great help. Just a great place to be.
Yep. Just recently we had a nice little collaborative programming effort, if you will. This was the question about how to mount drives. And so I posted what I promised, which was a quick and dirty way of mounting drives without being prompted for the password. And some of the members of the group said, there's a... not that what I did was wrong, but there was a better way to do it.
Yeah.
There was a better way to do something. And a few of our programming-minded members offered some suggestions and tips on making it better.
And it works? I saw the conversation happen. I've been busy and haven't tested it. But now I'm excited because I want to go and grab that Apple script so that I don't have to authenticate all the time. So
yeah, well, what I did was it was an Apple script that actually had terminal commands, but there's actually a way to do it directly
in Apple script. Nice. Okay,
and
cool.
So someone offered that suggestion as well. There's a number of ways to solve the problem.
Sweet. Well, thank you for doing that. Thanks for everybody that participated in that. And really, the group's a great place to be. I want to also thank Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com for providing all the bandwidth to get from us to you. Of course, our sponsors, Eero at Eero.com, where coupon code MGG gets you free overnight shipping, and they get those deals. VideoBlocks at VideoBlocks.com/MGG, where you can get a year's subscription for just $149. And of course, Harry's at Harry's.com, where coupon code MGG gets you a free post-shave balm added to your order of your free trial. Additionally, Gazelle at Gazelle.com, Fat Cat Software at FatCatSoftware.com/MGG, Smile at SmileSoftware.com/Geek, Otherworld Computing, absolutely, at MaxSales.com, Barebones Software at Barebones.com, and Casper at Casper.com/MGG. Thank you so much, folks. This was, as always, a great episode, and thanks to you for asking some great questions and providing some great information. Thanks to everybody in the chat room. John, thank you. In fact, do you have anything, one last bit of advice to share with us all?
I think I do, and it actually happened during this episode. I was supposed to give a quick tip, and it turned into my waxing poetic for several minutes. So, unfortunately, Dave, this time I got caught.
Made up.